11. Throwing a Donner Party at Sea. 5/13/2114. Today is Friday, though for many aboard the village barges scattered about the globe, and so on the Argyle shoestring, the distinctions between days and weeks and months tend to blur. But not for Ahmed Andruchenko, who obsessively marks off each date on calendars he makes himself. Bartleby Johnson has never seen the point of it. Sure, the tier farmers and hydroponics need to know the growing seasons, and there are still those who celebrate Christmas, Ramadan, Easter, Hanukkah, or the host of High Holy Days, Boxing Day, Launch Day, Goddamn May Day, and St. Bloody Valentine's Day. There is that peculiarly nostalgic minority. Johnson, he figures it's the norm ashore, that the terrestrials rejoice as a matter of course. But it's raw on the waves, and most old ways have been set aside for the monotony of the deep. Today is Friday, and he's repairing the aft solar sail array. It's tedious work, especially with such jerry-rigged replacement parts, but it beats to hell and back passing the afternoon with Ahmed. His latest tiresome obsession is the trans-Neptunian object 90377 Sedna, which, by his calculations and century-old astronomical charts, has recently overtaken the dwarf planet Eris as the farthest known celestial body orbiting the sun. That, and news of the civil unrest in the Greater Republic of India.
Better, thinks Johnson, that I spend however many hours dangling from this catwalk, suspended above the abyss with a wrench and spanner.
He is undeniably fond of Ahmed. They've been quartermates for 8 years now, ever since Johnson came aboard in Portugal. But the prattle wears on one's nerves and wears thin. So, times like this, he is grateful to be a mechanic, frequently called out to keep this ramshackle cobble together from breaking apart, to scatter across the waves and send them all to the drowning. Johnson is replacing a shot rivet at the base of the heliogyro when the sirens sound, warning that another vessel is coming alongside. He uses both feet to shove off the hull, swinging his harnesses around for a better view. It's an FS Navy ship, a high-speed trimaran wearing the name Silver Girl. Never a good sign when the Navy bothers sending a trimaran this far from littoral. A voice booms from the Silver Girl's loudspeakers, notifying the barge that it will be boarded in 5 minutes and to ready the ramp right quick. Johnson curses, takes a firm hold of the crisscross network of safety lines and hauls himself back up onto the Widowmaker. By the time he's unbuckled, navigated to the jib boom and bowsprit, then climbed down to red tier, through his spyglass across 200 yards, he can see the Navy men are filing onto the barge, two abreast, armed so that it will be obvious to everyone in the village that they mean business. This isn't some sort of routine inspection. Not that they'd ever send a literal trimaran for an inspection. It might be that crate of black market quinoa, flax and soy they bartered for a while back. Or it might be the two fugitives they, very unwisely, gave sanctuary down on the Houston wharves on a Texas run 6 months ago. Or it might be Ahmed. Johnson shoulders through the throng of worried, frightened and curious onlookers blocking his way. He moves as quickly as he possibly can, and once there's almost a scuffle when he overturns a melon cart. But by the time he's made it to the front of the crowd, one of the Navy men has hauled Ahmed from below decks and is leading him in cuffs towards the ramp. Ahmed's head is down, and he doesn't see Johnson. They take Ahmed Andruchenko away, and not once is there eye contact between him and Johnson. Two midshipmen in hard-shell hazmat suits are carrying Ahmed's footlocker with as much care as they would handle a nuke. A major reads off the charges to anyone who cares to hear them, and before half an hour has passed, the Silver Girl is rapidly putting distance between them, tacking westward towards shore. In another 15 minutes, it's only a glint on the horizon. On his way back to his quarters, Johnson is intercepted by another mechanic, a hulking Scotsman named Galbraith, who wants to know what the fuck that was all about.
He was your bunkmate, yeah? Figure you got to have a notion, yeah? What was in that fucknut's footlocker?
Johnson shakes his head and he tells Galbraith,
No idea. His business was his own. But you swim quick time, you can ask him for yourself, yeah?
You are a lying cocksucker,
the Scotsman shouts after him.
Yes, I am. Yes, I most surely am. But so are we all.
Ahmed traded a box of chips and circuits for the trunk almost a year back, so long ago now that Johnson can't even recall the name of the barge he found it on. But he does remember the contents. Nothing he'd conjured on overly long, and, truth told, he'd not ever thought of the trunk in quite a while. But now it was fresh in his mind, as that busted rivet on the sail. Mostly there'd only been an assortment of musty old books, a case of roundabouts no machine on a dump like the Argyle shoestring would ever be able to spin, and an assortment of motion cubes, equally fucking useless. Among the books was a volume on advanced chess tactics and another on cosmological inflation theory, and Johnson at first had assumed those were the reason Ahmed had bothered haggling for the lot, until he'd pulled a shiny lead cylinder from the jumble. There was a category AUN2814 biohazard designation pressed into one side and also into the lid of the cylinder, along with an MGRS coordinate and date. 19TEJ26298-9058-18213.
No,
Johnson had told him, grabbing for the cylinder, no matter how it was scaring him shitless.
That goes right the fuck overboard. Screw you, Bartleby, Ahmed said. It's mine. It cost dear, and it is mine.
There had ensued a tussle that ended in Johnson sporting a newly chipped incisor, and Ahmed an eye that would go black and blue as storm clouds. But Johnson had given up. He threatened to report Ahmed to the selectmen, but that hadn't made any difference. He threatened never again to play chess with Ahmed, and again, no dice. Johnson sat on the floor below the porthole, sweating and teasing the damaged tooth with the tip of his tongue.
You ain't gonna open that, you crazy son of a bitch. Even you're not that daft.
But then Ahmed did pop the seal. There was an audible hiss and a subsequent series of clicks as the cylinder released the inner capsule. A fog of liquid oxygen or nitrogen billowed from the violated artifact, and when it cleared, Johnson saw what had been shut away more than 101 years, clamped firmly in place between steel rods, a glowing tube, maybe 35, maybe 40 millilitres. Whatever was in the tube had a pearlescent quality about it, and it glowed ever so slightly in the twilight filling up the cabin.
You got no inkling what that shit is, Johnson said. Isn't that the marvel of it? I ought to murder you in your sleep, you bastard. Slit your throat, toss that shit overboard myself.
Johnson hadn't meant it, but he was frightened, and his tooth hurt, and he has always been apt to blurt such threats in the heat of the moment. Ahmed shrugged.
If you gotta, then you gotta, he said,
and gazed in wonder at the pearly tube before shutting and sealing the cylinder again.
So, thinks Johnson, sitting on the edge of his bunk. So somehow the military got word and came for it. Might be they've been dogging that can around for tens and tens, and Ahmed gets it and they get Ahmed. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Fuck.
That's when Johnson happens to glance at the shelf that holds Ahmed's books, and right off he notices one, and only one is missing. The White Queen.
Fuck us all,
he whispers, and lies down and stares at the underside of Ahmed's bunk. Soon enough, it'll be someone else's bunk.